22 grand pod. 22 grand pod. In the city that sounds nice.
Huh. So how long have you been doing the podcast?
It's getting on for before years next year, actually. Since the first lockdown kind of thing.
Yeah, it's funny how that definitely seemed to change a lot of people's lives, mine included.
Yeah, it just felt like I had the idea for a while, and it just felt like now or never at that point.
Is it named after the Rake song?
Yeah. So I had that idea. It's like working backwards from that, from the name, really.
That's how the best things work.
Where are you based? Are you in London?
No, I'm in just outside a place called Henlow in Hertfordshire.
Okay.
No one really knows where it is. It does exist.
Yeah, fair. Hertfordshire always sounds nice for some reason.
Yeah. Actually, no, what are you talking about? It's Bedfordshire. Literally on the border. So, and I was living in Hertfordshire until recently. But yeah, Bedfordshire, sorry.
Okay, fair enough. I assume you lived in London for a fair bit, though.
I did, yeah. I lived there until about 2015, 2014, something like that. It's one of those things, I think, when you first move to London, you kind of fall in love with it. And then it's like a kind of abusive girlfriend or boyfriend for the entirety of the time you're there. But it was for me anyway.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, I was there for about 5 years, but then moved up to Manchester. But I do miss it a bit, to be fair. But
it's where I find it weird going there now. And I don't know if it's, you know, just sounding like an old man or something, but it's a bit like going to a theme park now. It's like London land. It's not really, well, it's definitely not as real, if you'll excuse the expression, as you know, when I was living there. And I don't mean that, you know, oh, it's not dangerous or anything like that. It's just everything's so kind of sanitized and homogenized and Starbuckized and everything. It's just, it's kind of lost its soul a little bit.
But yeah, I know what you mean. I kind of feel like I moved down there in 2015, so I kind of missed out on, especially this era I talk about a lot, where it sounded so exciting in the early 2000s to be down there. But yeah, nice little segue there.
Yeah, you've done this before.
So I was interested. I went on the Snap Gallery's website.
Yeah.
And they had like a great little bio. So I just wanted to read that out because it's a good introduction, really. It says, Roger Sargent was born in London in 1970 to a maverick English teacher mother and a father who filmed TV classics, The Professionals and Minder. Casting shadows further, one grandfather was the clapper boy on Hitchcock's The 39 Steps. The other invented the police siren. Roger's transient childhood took place in Somerset and South Africa with a brief break in Gwent along the way. So yeah. Good starting point, I guess. Sounds like you had it in your blood, a bit of it.
A little bit, yeah. Although my dad always said, don't go into it. Don't go into photography or video or anything like that. Because you get treated like shit and they pay you badly. And he was right, really. but you just can't, you know. Maybe it's funny, like my son's 12 now, and I've not actively discouraged him, but he's really into photography and video now. And every time like someone's on telly or we hear a record, I say, oh, I've worked with them. And he's like, oh, that's amazing. See, it's really good doing what you did, isn't it? And it's like, well, yeah, I suppose.
Do you think it's maybe even harder now to start?
I mean, it's funny, I still get lots of people emailing me, either asking for advice or for assisting work or things like that. I mean, I can see, I'm not by any means out of touch with how one might do that now, but it's definitely harder. It's definitely, it's a bit like the same, it's not dissimilar to the way it is for bands. There's no labels anymore. So you have to kind of do it all yourself. And it's the same with photography and video. You kind of have to do it all yourself. You have to be you have to promote yourself. And in my, you know, I mean, looking back, you know, I was talking to someone the other day about 1 year I went to America, like I went to New York, 11 times in 1 year. And that And that wasn't that they weren't the only foreign trips I did. There's nothing like that now in terms of magazines and things, you know, that will send you on assignments like that. And that's a real shame. I'm not sure what we've got instead is a great replacement either.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into all that, I guess. But it would be remiss of me not to ask about your granddad inventing the police, Aaron. That's a good fact to have, isn't it?
Yeah, it was the only way that I could breeze over the fact that he worked for GCHQ. So there's a lot of stuff I can't maybe say that about what he did. But he was involved with a lot of things after the war, like nuclear early warning systems and things like that.
Okay, right.
Quite a character.
Definitely. Yeah. And what does it mean by a maverick English teacher mother?
Well, my mum, who's no longer with us anymore, but she definitely never did anything by the book. I remember one time when I was about 14, she was working in a sort of private school in Johannesburg, and she wanted to prove to the people that owned it that their security systems were lax. So she went in the middle of the night with my then stepfather and stole all the computers.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so definitely proved the point.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, what was that like then? So Somerset, South Africa, quite a big experience as a child.
Yeah, it was. South Africa was definitely one of those places at the time that was, it couldn't help but be formative in your formative years. I was there in, around 83 to 87. So it was during the worst times of apartheid. There was a state of emergency declared, not because I arrived, but as I arrived, there was a state of emergency declared. And if anyone who recently come over from Britain, you knew that what was being shown on the television wasn't a true representation of what was actually going on in the country itself. So it was kind of a weird place to be, politically and so on. It had a different effects on different people. Some people it kind of radicalized them, in a socialist way, which is kind of the way that I became. And some people, they went the other way, unfortunately.
Right, yeah. I mean, I imagine that would be quite a good place to start taking photographs. Were you old enough to have a camera and stuff?
Only in a very passive way. That's when I did start taking pictures, but it was mainly like the family stuff. Like I was always the one that was taking pictures when we're on holiday and stuff. But already musically, because really most of my friends hated being there and sort of hated the environment and for various obvious reasons. So we identify very much with Britain and British music and stuff like that. So I was buying the NME when I was out there, and it was the equivalent of a month's pocket money to get ahead of me, because it was, anything like that was banned. So it was kind of imported like a grey import, I guess. So it was really expensive. Likewise, any kind of clothes like Doc Martens and things like that were ludicrously expensive. But nevertheless, we'd get like an NME and share it around, and that's how we kind of kept in touch with what was going on, and Smash Hits and stuff like that but that was a bit of a lifeline, definitely.
Yeah, fair. So how old were you at that point then?
I was sort of between the age of 14 and 18.
Okay, right.
So proper formative years.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. So who was influencing your music taste up to that point then? Or what was, kind of thing?
God, I listened to lots of different things, from The Smiths, Madness, right up to Crass, Conflict, Rudimentary Peni. I got very into kind of left field punk rock music, especially more so when I got back to the UK as well. But yeah, just anything really that identified with where we'd come from.
Yeah. I'm always interested about the Rodriguez story as well. Like, it was, do you remember Rodriguez being a big deal in South Africa at that point?
Not at the time.
Okay, right.
Yeah. I mean, I still haven't seen that film. But I can only remember a few bands that were famous. I mean, most of the, this wouldn't include him, but most of the stuff out there, like, it was a cultural cesspit. So, you know, because you never got any indigenous music. It was just kind of white Africana music. That was fucking terrible.
Fair play. So yeah, you mentioned going back to the UK then, and you ended up on a course with a renowned documentary photographer called David Hearn. Is that right?
Yeah.
So how did that come around?
I originally started doing photography as an elective at sixth form college. And it was really because I think the only other options were things that involved getting really cold and muddy in the winter, and that didn't strike me as much fun. So, and they were talking about lots of darkroom work and things like that. So I thought that would be nice and warm. And I was in Derbyshire at the time. And I eventually kind of used it as a way to get into gigs, because I'd sort of give people photographs and so on. And I built up a bit of a portfolio of work. And there were a few of us that were applying to this college in Newport. And it was back then it was renowned as like the sort of best in the country or the best in the world or whatever. And a friend of mine went for his interview the day before I did. And when I spoke to him and got back, he just went, "You've got absolutely no chance of getting in. There's just no way. It's really hard." And so I kind of went without any nerves at all, and just went on about all the bands that I loved and taking pictures of them and all this sort of stuff. And they let me in.
Yes. And what was it like working? Were you working directly with David Hearn then?
By that stage, he was more like a visiting lecturer. He was still running the course, but he wasn't the head of the course anymore. So it was Daniel Meadows and Clive Landon were the heads then, who were equally fantastic. I mean, it was an incredible course to do. It was really intensive, you know, so we would be out shooting from 9 in the morning till, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 at night. The camaraderie was amazing. The first half of the course was pretty much getting you to learn the skills of taking pictures rather than, you know, the art of taking photos, because their ethos was that, you know, if you're not in command of your tools of your trade, then it's going to get in the way of what you do. So you need to be really good at composing and getting the right moment and things like that. And so we would just go out, shoot, you know, maybe someone hammering a nail into a piece of wood, come back, and then we'd get a one-to-one critique. And if you didn't get it quite, you know, 100%, you'd be back out and you'd have to go to that same person hammering the nail in a bit of wood maybe 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times, you know. And it definitely gets rid of those cobwebs, definitely.
Yeah, is it like quite hard and fast rules then when it comes to photography, like quite strict guidelines to follow sometimes?
It's not so much that, it's just if you walk into a situation and you're fiddling with your camera and you don't know what you're doing, you're missing stuff immediately. And if you're, they had lots of sort of catchphrases, but one of them was, if it's not good enough, you're not close enough. And that can, you know, that can me that can work on a couple of levels, but essentially, you know, you need to be familiar with what you're doing, and not be afraid of it. And those kind of watchwords stayed with me forever, really.
And you already had a bit of an insight to like filmmaking with your dad anyway, kind of thing?
A little bit, yeah. But I mean, he did mostly drama and then news. My granddad did pretty much the same things at the BBC, but I didn't really know my granddad, or I didn't really know my dad till I was about 11 or 12 anyway. And so, whereas you might be getting constant sort of, you know, I don't know what the word is really, but whereas you might be guided by your parents, living in a completely different country to my dad, you know, I kind of missed out on quite a lot of that.
Right, okay, yeah.
Sporadic.
Right. And then, yeah, it says something like you nearly dropped out of that course to go on the road with a band called The Fabulous, who's made up of enemy journalists and porn stars. Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Any stories there?
Yeah. Very unclean ones. Yeah, no, but so Simon Dudfield, or Simon Spence, as he is now known, was the lead singer of the band. He's like a world-renowned author now. He's written books on the Rolling Stones and loads of other people. Martin Goodacre was the guitarist. He took probably the most famous picture of Kurt Cobain, the one that was on the NME cover when Kurt died. And James Brown was the manager, and he went on to do Loaded and
I know you mean, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it was a great little hothouse environment for creativity in that respect. And they would live in the dream in terms of they'd seen how badly people in rock and roll behave, and so they'd been taking notes clearly. yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, yeah, sounds it, to be fair. And then, yeah, it says on graduating, you had brief spells at Melody Maker and Idea Magazine. And I mean, when it comes to the bands, you've photographed, it's like a who's who, so it's hard to know where to start, I guess. But what are your early memories of like those first bands you were taking photos of?
I mean, mostly it was live photography at the beginning. It was almost like doing an apprenticeship. And I went to NME first, then Melody Maker, and Melody Maker gave me my first gigs. And weirdly, I think Rage Against the Machine might have been one of the first gigs I did for Melody Maker, which is insane. It was at the Underworld, and it was only half full.
Wow.
That was mad. It was really just like trying to do anything to get in there, you know. So I would get photo passes from the band's PRs and management and stuff like that, and just you know, as well as getting commissions, I would just go out and shoot bands and give them to the NME in the hope that they would notice me. So initially, like I say, yeah, I was working at Melody Maker for a while, and then there came a point with NME where I said, look, I'd rather be working for you, but you need to give me more work. And they said, yeah, all right, well, let's do it. If I'm honest, like early on, I only really wanted to photograph Nirvana and Screaming Trees and bands like that. But it, you know, there was such a hierarchy at the NME, it was really difficult to get anywhere near any bands like that. So the only thing that you could do is really get in with bands at a ground level. And inevitably, it had to be bands that you loved. So I was working with bands like John Spencer Blues Explosion and a lot of the kind of left field American music that no one else, like Green Day, another band that no one else had really heard of. And you'd get to photograph them to a certain level, and then you know, the old guard at the NME, they would take over, and it was really soul destroying until I became the old guard at NME. And it was quite right.
Yeah, fair. So how would you hear about these bands then, to get on like the ground level type thing?
I guess the same way that I always used to hear about music, and that was like listening to John Peel and going to record stores and, you know, buying random records because I knew the label, or I'd read a review or something like that. It was, I know it's a lot easier to find stuff, and I do avail myself of Instagram and Facebook and stuff to discover new bands. But it was quite exciting, you know, buying a record that you'd never heard a note of and finding out if it was any good. It wasn't always any good.
So then how would you guarantee you'd be able to take photos? And would you go in the the enemy's name, or would you just go as a freelance type thing?
You could. I mean, after a while, I was just getting commissions, so it was in the enemy's name. And then you'd meet people. If you were doing a trip, you know, say to Portsmouth or Brighton or whatever, you'd often be with a PR, and you get talking to them, and they'd say, "Oh, we've got this other band. If you fancy taking photos for them," and then so you'd get to do, you know, more sort of posed stuff, portrait stuff, and just gradually kind of widen a network of friends and colleagues and things like that, and yeah, you know, hopefully do good work and get re-employed, you know, again and again.
Yeah, yeah. And with Nirvana, then what are your memories of watching them type thing?
Yeah, it's a bit of a sore point, that one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was. If I'm pretty sure it was either the day of my birthday or the day after my birthday. I can't remember now. But so it was the only time I got to see them. I missed them about three times before that, and it was at the Roseland Ballroom in New York. And I was with with Enemy, and I was with a writer, and we were doing a piece on the whole thing. So that, you know, we'd go and see four or five bands in the night, and I was like, oh. I think I'd got into to the pit, and it was one of the craziest shows I've done. There's literally just bodies coming over every 5 seconds. You know, you're getting kicked in the back of the head. You can barely hold the camera up straight half the time, but it was great. And then I got out of the pit, met up with the journalist, and I said, he said, "Oh, we've got to go and see another band." And I was like, "Oh, come on! This is like the first time I've ever got to see Nirvana. It's my birthday, as far as I was concerned." And so we had to go and see Juliana Hatfield, who was great and everything, but it literally played an empty venue,
right,
somewhere else in New York.
And so how many songs did you have to leave after with Nirvana?
It was about six, maybe eight, something like that. So I got to see a few, but it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't ideal.
Yeah, and what year was that?
94.
Right, okay. Yeah. So really, like, the kind of massive period, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, that Roseland show apparently is legendary now. There's clips online and stuff like that. It's the one where he was wearing that black and red jumper. But yeah, a bit gutted.
Yeah, fair enough. At least you saw on there. And then I saw you did an exhibition of Oasis, so I'm guessing you must have started taking photos of them fairly early.
Yeah, I did the first London show. I think it was the first London show anyway, when they played the Water Rats. It was like a showcase gig for the Creation put on, and I got a picture of I just, you know, partly being in the right place. You know, I got a picture of Liam looking right into the camera that they ended up using for adverts and stuff when Supersonic came out, and sort of grew a relationship with Creation. I ended up being, this sounds a bit more exciting than it was, but ended up being their in-house photographer, brackets with the exception of Oasis. Although I did get to shoot them a lot more because of doing that. Got to go to a hell of a lot of Oasis shows and don't remember many of them.
Yeah, so on Instagram, Big Scott Energy was asking, how many times have you seen Oasis live and when was the first time? So we've covered the first time, but you're saying a lot of times you saw them, basically. Yeah.
I really couldn't say how many. I mean, probably if I sat down, but I'm guessing in the region of 50.
Wow, yeah.
Because a lot of, you know, they do like three nights in a row, and I'd be there for all of those. And yeah, because if you had a bit of a relationship with a band, the Enemy would tend to send you to do that band, especially if they were difficult, which Oasis often were. Yeah, they'd send people that had a bit of a relationship, so that helped.
Yeah, fair. And were you big into them in general and in terms of the music?
Yeah, 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 definitely. It was, I mean, it definitely felt like there was something going on, you know, and I'd been, what I was going to say actually earlier was that up until then, up until kind of New Wave of New Wave. I don't know if you know what that was or when that was, but it was just before Britpop, and they were. So it was like a sort of proto Britpop movement that never really went anywhere. But if it hadn't happened, Britpop may not have happened. But up until then, it was pretty fucking diabolical. yeah, apart from some of the American bands, it was just dire. So when Britpop, for want of a better word, came along, it was nice to be part of something exciting again.
Yeah. And how do you feel like Britpop compares to what was going on in the early 2000s? Is there any like notable differences, do you think?
It's weird being like kind of being part of both times, or being, you know, involved in both times. I'd say that the early 2000s was, it definitely felt kind of grittier and less organized by labels and things like that. You know, there was, the labels jumped on bands in the Britpop days, and they were all trying to get the next Oasis, whereas I think they were a little bit terrified of bands like the Libertines. So so it wasn't really the same kind of reaction, and it definitely felt earthier, if that's a kind way of saying it, I suppose. I mean, the drugs were kind of nastier, and you know, it was like Britpop was very much, I mean, there was a bit of smack and stuff around, but it was basically cocaine. But in the early thousands, it was crack, heroin, and cocaine. It was all the kids doing it as well, and that wasn't nice.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Libertines, and obviously taking many iconic photos of them. Like, what are your early memories of being around them, kind of thing? Or how did you first hear about them?
First heard about them, I'd moved out of London. I one of the many times that I'd considered quitting the business, and I'd moved out of London, and a friend of mine who's the press officer said, look, I've got this, I think I'm going to be working with this really good band, come and see them. And I was like, oh fuck, all right. So I would live quite far out, so I drove in, like about an hour and a half, drove into London to Cherry Jam, where they were playing. And I don't think they'd been signed yet, they were just about to be signed. And it was exciting, you know, it was genuinely, it was really shambolic, but it was really exciting and a little bit frightening, which is kind of ticks boxes for me with bands.
Yeah.
So I kind of jumped on the roller coaster and just to see where it went, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you were there throughout the whole journey, really. Yeah. So it's interesting to get your take on things. Like, how quickly did things get a bit fraught and a bit dark, do you think?
I'd say it was really good, positive. Well, it seemed to me anyway, really good, positive fun until the first Up the Bracket tour. And I remember we were coming back from, God, you may know better than me on this, but I'm pretty sure we were coming back from Birmingham or Manchester, and Peter just got off the bus and he was supposed to get back on and didn't. And then nobody saw him again. And that just seemed odd to me. Above and beyond, you know, wanting to do drugs or anything like that, I think looking back now, it's easy to see in hindsight, but I think it was probably like a mental health issue, really, you know, because I know now that he gets really really stressed about shows, and I think if there are too many shows in a row, it's not good for him. And I think it's probably, you know, like most of the things in our lives, if that's the way you are when you're younger, it's probably going to be the same. It's probably going to be true when you're older as well. So I think it's probably that. I think the drugs were a crutch for that more than anything else.
And you say like you're traveling with them and stuff. So I guess, you know, I've talked to other photographers who said it's, no, a lot of it's about building relationships with bands and people. Were you able to, like, I don't know, build a good relationship with them from the off type thing?
Pretty much, yeah. There was a bit of a kind of baptism of fire initially. You know, we'd go out quite a lot in London, and I'd end up back at the Albion Rooms, and I was a bit older than them, but they, you know, they kind of treated me like one of the gang, you know. And it was, yeah, there was a bit of kind of one-upmanship all the time, you know, about staying up. Oh, no, you've got to come out. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. You've got to stay out late. Yeah, almost like a kind of initiation into a gang or something.
Did it in the past with flying colours type thing?
Yeah, I've never been known to let people down in that department.
And then I was interested in the Future Legends exhibition you did. Was that a kind of thing around quite a few bands of that time?
So yeah, that was after the Libertines exhibition that I did. Proud were keen to do something else that after the success of the Libs exhibition, because the Libs exhibition was only on for 3 days. Proud didn't really want to do it. So they gave me so in between exhibitions, they have a 3 day changeover time. So they break everything down, start putting the next one up. And they said, you can have the space in between two exhibitions to do your Libertines exhibition. And it sounds really braggy, but it's true. They had more people through the door in those 3 days than they'd ever had for any other exhibition that they'd ever done. So they were quite keen to do something else. And I thought the kind of best thing, and this is kind of going back to where I'd come from at university, or college, sorry, because it wasn't at university, would be to do almost like a survey. It sounds boring if I put it like that, but almost like a survey of the bands that were around at the time. And you know, not all of them ended up as Future Legends, obviously, but it was just to kind of encapsulate what was going on at that moment.
Yeah, I saw your caption on one of the, was it a photo with Block Party, said that you kind of almost demanded to take photos of them because you thought they were going to be great, type of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I just heard one single. That was the thing. There were so many great bands putting out great records. Some of them only ever put out one great record, but it was, it didn't feel like they were all trying to copy each other's sound either.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. Do you not have a website anymore or something?
Not at the moment, no. I've kind of let everything lapse because during COVID, I decided to study.
Okay.
That's kind of what I've been doing for the last 3 years. So I've just kind of let everything lapse. So I've just got my Instagram, which I've just literally in the last few days started working again. It's weird. I did a couple of shoots recently, and I kind of starting to fall in love with photography again, because I hadn't really done a lot of photography in the last 10, 15 years. But going through my old stuff and it's kind of reinvigorated me a little bit. I'm not sure where I'm going to go afterwards and how much work I'll choose to do. I'll just see where it goes. It's really easy to burn out doing this sort of thing, because you'll do one good shoot and then you'll get asked to photograph another band, you know, four people, four blokes, you know, and then another band, four blokes, another band, four blokes, and it starts to get incredibly monotonous. And I don't have the longest attention span in the world. So that's why I've ended up managing bands. I've had a record label. I've, you know, now I'm studying. I just can't like mentally keep still. So here we are.
What have you been studying out of interest then?
Psychology.
Psychology, right, okay. That's interesting. Is that something you've always been interested in then?
Yeah, very much so. Very much so, yeah. I mean, it's a fair amount since my son was born. My son has autism, so there's an element to that. But yeah, I've always been really fascinated. And yeah, lockdown seemed like a really good opportunity to take a look at that, you know?
Yeah. I'm actually going through early stages of that with my little boy. He's we know he's neurodivergent to some degree, but we're trying to get a helping place before he starts school. It's a bit of a learning curve for us as well. Yeah,
it's tricky because you don't always get the help that you need at schools and things like that. And yeah, you're right, to get it in place as early as possible. It took us 5 years to get it.
Oh, wow, okay.
Because he's very high functioning, so. But that doesn't always mean that everything's, you know, happy-go-lucky, you know.
Yeah. No, it's certainly a few ups and downs. Yeah. Okay, if you look at like cover photographs, then just interested because obviously you've done some iconic Libertines ones, and I was reading one you did with Fatboy Slim. Maybe it wasn't a cover photo, but somewhere you get direction. Okay, right. Somewhere you get like a lot of direction, and I imagine with Libertines it's more down to you, maybe.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, with them, it was such a victory just to get the four of them in the same place for any stretch of time. I mean, even the first session we did, Peter and Cole turned up like 2 hours late. The first session we did, they turned up 5 or 6 hours late to their own house, which is pretty spectacular. So it kind of set the standard for going forwards. So yeah, I mean, I always tended to work quite quickly anyway. In my previous life, I did a lot of rap and hip hop acts who don't, you know, they're huge and don't give you a lot of time. So I was quite used to working quickly, and so. It would, you know, it would have been nice to be a lot more studious about working with them, but it just doesn't work like that. Not in my experience anyway. So they were quite self-aware, and Peter and Carl have always been quite fashion oriented, but it would come together sometimes really like a scattergun. So they needed someone to kind of, you know, make it work together rather than look like four people from different bands.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen quotes from Pete saying he would literally dress the band, like, yeah, he told them all to wear leather jackets and stuff like that.
Yeah. Before I was involved, they basically copied the Strokes.
yeah.
And, you know, but it was a wise move, you know, and their homage to the Strokes was on a few levels, but it was very much with their own take and a very big sense of Britishness about it. So I think the two coexist really nicely together.
No, yeah, definitely. They pulled it off for sure. Is that a band you've worked with before?
I shot them live a few times, met them a few times, and I shot them for the Enemy cover for the Brat Awards. That it was the Strokes with Kylie Minogue.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Which is your favourite Libertines cover out of interesting? Do you have one?
Probably from the second album, just because it was such a rigmarole to get it all together. Literally camping outside Peter's flat for 4 hours, knocking on his door, trying to get him to approve it.
Yeah, fair. And then moving into album covers, then obviously the famous second album cover at the Tap and Tin. Did you expect that to be as iconic as it was?
No, not at all. I mean, I knew that there'd be something quite good that would come out of it, but not anything like that.
Yeah. And what are your memories of that night, really? Obviously, it's gone down in folklore kind of thing.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, it was incredible. It was really emotional. I'd gone to the prison with Carl in the morning to meet Peter, and then just left them to their own devices for a few hours. Carl was horribly drunk by the time I met up with him later. I think, you know, because of the nerves and everything, he'd just been drinking all day. And yeah, it was one of the best shows I've ever been to, without a doubt. Just so, so joyful.
Yeah, yeah. We had spoke to Dean Fragile recently about the gig. And it's interesting, because I was asking him about Early Baby Shambles, and you've posted some recent pictures from Early Baby Shambles gigs.
Yeah.
And he was kind of... he was mixed about that whole time. He says it was like he doesn't look back on it massively fondly. He wanted the Libertines to stay together. Like, what do you remember from that time?
Well, yeah, I mean, it obviously everyone wanted them to stay together, but the circumstances were so terrible. I mean, everything that happened was just diabolical, really. And the reactions to it were diabolical. And for them to have stayed together under those circumstances would have been catastrophic. So it was the lesser of many evils, the band splitting up and forming other bands. And, you know, at least they're still alive. Just about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an exciting time to look back on some of those, like, Baby Shambles gigs, really good kind of thing. And then the idea for the book, really, with Anthony Thornton, was that a bit of a no-brainer when you got together type thing?
Yeah, I mean, Anthony and I had been around almost as long as each other, you know, around the Libs scene or whatever you want to call it. And I can't even remember ever having a conversation about let's do a book, but I think we must have done it. But like you say, I think it was just a no-brainer. We've got to do something that covers the whole thing. And it was so egalitarian, you know, the idea to do something with equal pictures and words. It was a little pool of joy in the middle of sort of horror.
Yeah, fair. And I imagine that NME at that point, was it an exciting place to be, like in and around the offices, or you're not really?
No, it was. It was definitely. I mean, obviously, they'd by that stage. I mean, there were lots of things going on at NME at that point that made it a little bit uncomfortable. They were trying to make, and they succeeded in making most of the photographers sign really draconian contracts and sign away all the rights to their photographs and all these sorts of things. For no fucking use either, because, you know, NME doesn't really exist anymore. So what was the point of that? But anyway, sorry. they would wheel me out to do Libertine stuff because they knew that no one else would really get anything. And that was great because, there was obviously a lot of mileage in that. But it was, yeah, it was a bittersweet thing, really, because I found NME at that point. It was just awful.
All right, okay. Yeah, because I watched a documentary involved in Music Through the Lens. And I'm watching a clip from it today where someone was saying, one of the photographers was saying, you know, never sign away the copyright type thing. Is that usually the rule of thumb?
It should be, yeah, because in our, you know, your archive as a photographer is effectively your pension. Most creatives don't end up, you know, putting money into pension plans and all that, unless you're Rankin or something. You know, you don't get enough money to do that. So your archive is your pension, but a lot of the magazines in the noughties started land grabbing rights, and some bands even did it as well. Stone Roses, for fuck's sake, did it. You know, and to this day, there are bands that won't let you in the pit if you're doing a live shot unless you sign over the rights to those photos to that band, which I just think is diabolical. I mean, it's easy for me to say, but I would just not work with a band that did that. It's just criminal.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. And yeah, just at what point did you transition into being a bit of a director then?
it was around the when the band reformed. I was always interested, and I did actually do a really brief stint, although nothing ever came of it, like in the very early noughties with, I did some video with Coldplay and stuff, but I literally like couldn't, I didn't like the technology back then. It was so difficult to compare to how it is now. So I just stopped. But yeah, when the band reformed, there was interest in the documentary, and it was just seemed like the management just said, we can't imagine sort of letting anyone in else in at this stage. It would be really difficult. So would you do it? And I said, yes, thank you. I'll give it a go. literally, I think it was like within 2 weeks we had to start. So there was very much kind of learning on the fly. And the first couple of things I shot were really bad. Like, you know, all the settings wrong on the camera and things like that. But we got there in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
I
event, you know, inevitably started doing music videos and really enjoyed that. But it's like anything, you know, you can burn out. I mean, I love trampoline, but I've done 26 videos for trampoline.
Right.
Which has got to be some kind of record for them. and I would always work with them, don't get me wrong, but it's so easy to burn out. And especially got my brain. It's really easy.
How does it work with videos then? Is it sometimes your idea, sometimes the band idea, to kind of work together on that kind of thing?
Ideally, I like collaborating with people rather than sort of, you know, saying, right, it's going to be set in the future and the robots are taking over the world. It's no, I'd rather work with someone and, you know, have a meeting of minds. I mean, I did a few videos with Baxter Jury, and that's how we always worked. It was always just me and him. Never had any other crew even really. And we just sort of thrash out ideas and get somewhere loose, shoot, and then thrash it out a bit more. That was always, it's always the fun when you work with somebody. I don't like, in fact, I rarely, if I get asked to put a treatment in for something, I rarely do it because I just find it either you want me to work for you or you don't. You know, there's enough of my stuff out there. If you like it, then let's go for it. I'm not gonna, it's not that I don't like competing or anything, it's just I'd rather work with someone from the start.
Yeah, you don't have to like pitch for a job type thing.
Yeah.
I know it's interesting, one of your comments about the Gunga Din video with Libertines, just there's a quote from the director of photography saying it's the most insane production he'd ever done. But you were like, well, it's just the Libertines.
Yeah, it was pretty bad though. Yeah, that was a really professional production company that we had as well. I remember doing the one after that, the Heart of the Matter, and the producer literally said, we've got to shut this down, we've got to shut this down. This, because he thought that Peter was going to really, you know, there's a scene where he holds a syringe to the guy's neck. The producer genuinely thought that he was going to inject him in the neck. I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? What? He's not an absolute crazed madman. He's not going to inject whatever the fuck was in that syringe into this guy's neck. I think it was tea or something.
Yeah. And then I just want to talk a bit more about knowing some bystanders. Like, just interested in, did you conduct a lot of the interviews then for that?
Which, sorry?
For knowing some bystanders. You were the one conducting a lot of the interviews.
So for that, there was, I was doing the interviews but I had a really good friend of mine, David Standen, and a cameraman a lot of the time, or a documentary filmmaker called Christian Brown. And it was basically the three of us on set most of the time. Very small, like, and none of us were really, like, David's a producer, Christian is an editor, really, and he edited most of the film. So none of us were really, this wasn't like our prime job, do you know what I mean? So we were all learning on the fly. So it was so difficult to get anybody else around them and anyone else that would be prepared to be around them. you know, given the sort of things that went on previous, you know, there were people that literally just wouldn't want to, didn't want to get involved. It's weird now. And then you see things like Louis Theroux and stuff. And, but back then it was, you know, because Peter was, you know, injecting whenever the fuck he wanted to, you know, which is what you do when you're an addict. People, you know, quite understandably didn't want to be around that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I was watching it earlier today and this week, and yeah, the interviews with Carl are really interesting. Like, is it quite hard to get them that relaxed, or do you have that relationship at that point where he knew he could trust you type thing?
I mean, with Carl, I was probably closer with Carl from the start, so that was easier. And I kind of knew a lot of the backstory. I mean, it's by no means perfect or anything, that film. I would do it differently now, for instance, you know. But the thing I didn't want was just loads of talking heads, just loads of random journos and stuff chipping in their opinions. I just wanted it to be the band, really. But we were still at a point where it was, you were either with Peter or you were with Carl, and Peter thought that I was just with Carl. So he didn't really engage with the film as much as we wanted to. Plus, he was going through a really bad time with his illness. So that made it harder as well.
Yeah. Was that the time when they had like separate tour buses and stuff?
That, yeah, it was.
Yeah, that's pretty wild, isn't it?
In fact, I don't think, I mean, at one point we got to Leeds Festival in four separate tour buses, which none of the band could use because they had their kids with them and they weren't sure to take kids on.
Oh, so wow.
Four pretty much empty tour buses.
I know, like, you hear them talk about it, and I think Pete's made a reference to, like, how many people made money off that initial reunion. Seems like, yeah, a pretty wild production, yeah.
The problem is that, and I can't blame anyone for this because it's just the way it was, but people were a bit afraid of Peter and afraid to, and I'm not talking about the band, I'm talking about management and people around. They were fearful that something would go wrong, so they tried to set it up so that to minimize that as much as possible. But it was, I think if we'd sat down and talked and thought about it a bit better, then people would realize that nothing bad was going to happen, really. People might be late, but that's just par for the course, you know. It wasn't going to be dangerous and horrible. It was just going to be a bit shambolic or disorganized, but
yeah.
A lot of money was wasted.
I mean, yeah, there's obviously moments in the film where Pete doesn't turn up to rehearsals and stuff. Was there any moments where you thought it wasn't going to happen, or do you just think, oh, that's, like you say, it's par for the course?
Yeah, I don't think there was ever any real worry that it wasn't going to happen. It was just a bit of a shame, I think, that in terms of how it affected relationships and things like that, the fear and the miscommunication and you know, the other three, as it were, being sat around twiddling their thumbs, that, you know, and not wanting to get angry about it, and, you know, doing their best not to get angry about it, but you know, what other reaction are you going to have?
Yeah. And objectively, now looking back, it looks like the best gig was probably the initial one at Kentish Town Forum. Was that the same for you?
It's funny, I don't really remember them in chronological order anymore. The Leeds gig was amazing.
Yeah, I was at that one, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. That, for me, was more fun than Reading. Partly
in what way? Just because they were a bit looser at that point?
Not so much looser. I think they'd all slept. That was
right. Okay.
And it was the first big show. I mean, the forum ones were great, but that was the first big show. But it's funny. It's funny. Until you said that, I had it in my head that the forum shows were after that. That goes to show how unreliable my memory is. But they were great. Don't get me wrong. They were great.
Yeah, yeah. And how did they compare? Can you compare them to the early shows, or is it just like a different time?
No, they compare really favourably, I think. and this isn't, you know, casting aspersions at all, much more favorably, I'd say, than recent shows. They're a different band now.
Mm.
I think this isn't a good thing, obviously, but I think because of the kind of weirdness and the sort of strained relations and stuff like that, that's why they would compare to the early shows. Whereas now there's a lot more harmony. Since the second album, you know, the third album, there's a lot more harmony in the band, so things are a lot easier in that respect. But that definitely wasn't what it was like when they first reformed. So it did kind of felt like we were just carrying on.
Yeah, yeah. And the name of that film, does it come from that photo you took of the band where it's got that graffiti in the background? Yeah. That's like a happy accident type thing.
That we were gonna use that in the film anyway, and it just seemed like, yeah, it just that is a Burroughs quote, and I always remember it being really resonant with, especially around the time Peter got chucked out of the band and things like that. It just always resonated, so it seemed like a really natural title to have.
Yeah, that's good. And then I saw a quote saying there was a flag that your girlfriend had meticulously prepared. What did it actually say on the flag?
Dulce decorum est, I think.
Ah, okay.
Which is from a World War One poem. I think it's Dulce decorum est. Which just means something like it's proper and right. So the idea being that, you know, it's proper and right that they're here together again. Yeah, but that didn't stay around for long, Peter Nick. That that's where that is now.
Yeah, yeah. And then you ended up doing the actual third album cover a bit last minute, is that right?
It was last minute in terms of when we shot it, yeah. It wasn't last minute in terms of when we meant to shoot it.
Okay, right.
Because I was originally employed to go out to Thailand for 2 weeks at the beginning of the session, and then 1 week at the end. And I ended up staying the entire time because we hadn't got what we needed. And I think we got that literally on the last day.
Okay, cool. I don't think
Peter had slept for 4 days or something. I mean, he was literally seeing people floating in the air and all kinds of weird shit. I don't know.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Have you done many other album covers? Or?
I have, but not for quite as significant artists. And I couldn't actually tell you. Paddington's, I did one of their record covers.
Oh, really? Oh, the first one's first?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes.
And I didn't mean by not as significant in reference to the Paddingtons.
I think I'll say that.
Love the Paddingtons. But it's funny, I'm not one of these people that kind of chalks off covers and things like that. I've got somewhere like a box full of stuff like that, but it's really about the images themselves, you know.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I'll appreciate your time, Roger. We'll move on to the fan questions. Just before we do, actually, I just wanted to ask about the Eminem picture. What was it like working with him?
Oh, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Hilarious. He was like just at the crest of that madness fame wave, you know. Yeah, he was just brilliant. Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Did like the crowds differ with different kind of scenes as well, obviously? It's get more obsessive for different ones type thing.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say so much for him on that tour because that was on the Vans Warped Tour. So it was kind of, you get kind of a mad, weird metal crowd type, or punk metal crowd on those tours. But yeah, yeah. Some of the hip hop crowds can be a little less friendly, let's say, than
yeah. Okay,
especially,
cool.
Especially if you're pushing your way to the front of a gig, you know, understandably, I would get pissed off.
All right, cool. Well, first one is from Bobby Needs, who says, what happened to your coffee table photography book that was due out this year via the Snap Galleries?
Just never got around to it. I got so We will get there. We will get there. I ended up having to put off a couple of exams with my university course for personal reasons. So yeah, that's what happened to that, I'm afraid. But we will get there.
Have you thought about doing like a book in general, like a more of an autobiography type thing?
People have mentioned that. It's, I don't know. I don't feel like I've had that kind of weird, interesting a life. And I can't remember all of it. So maybe before the memory goes.
Yeah. If you have another lockdown.
Yeah.
Okay. Carl Barat News on Instagram says, when is he going to let us see the decades worth of the libertines and dirty pretty things photos he took? I suppose they mean maybe the unseen ones. I don't know.
Well, I've got so much. It's funny, my libertines archive is pretty huge. My dirty pretty things archive is enormous. It would be fun. I didn't get to see, unfortunately, I didn't get to see their show when they reformed. I really wanted to. I had such fun shooting them, and they were great. And I've got some fantastic stuff. So I am going to put some out on the Instagram anyway. I'm just trying. It's funny with the Instagram. I'm just really enjoying, like, just putting live stuff up at the moment for some reason. I'm just really, really enjoying that because it's making me look for stuff that I wouldn't normally look for. And I've got to scan a hell of a lot of stuff in as well. I've got 20, 30 litre boxes of negatives, probably half of which haven't been scanned yet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'll get there.
Yeah, yeah. From Count the Embers, any updates on the 1001 Candles concert recording? Are you still working on it?
Might have to avoid this one for legal.
I don't even know what that is, to be honest.
It was a show they did at Shepherd's, not Shepherd's Bush, at Hackney Empire.
Okay, right.
Yeah, there was some nothing to do with the band, but the yeah, there were some discrepancies about finances with that.
Right, okay. We'll move on then. Answered one from Adam Morisutti about how did the Bound Together book come about. Marta from Arcadia says, can you please release some more behind-the-scenes Libertines pictures? And also, can you elaborate on your quote where you said that Peter and Carl should get a room?
In answer to the first question, yes. As soon as I've got a few more live pictures out of the way, I'm going to start doing like backstage pictures because I've never really put any of those out. So I'm going to work my way back from live to backstage and then to post stuff again because, like I say, I'm finding some really interesting stuff that I haven't looked at for years with the, you know, going through the live stuff. So yeah, I will that. And the get a room, just Google it.
Fair play. Barton_Paul22 says, are you proud of how there are no innocent bystanders turned out?
Proud isn't really the right word. Like I said, I would have done it differently now. I'd have done it differently probably a year later. You know, it's kind of beautiful but flawed.
Yeah. Ian Gilbert says, I don't know if you'll know the answer to this, but will there ever be a chance the Libertines will tour the US?
I don't, I mean, I sort of know the answer to that, but I can't really talk about it on here. I think in the long run, yes, but there's some work to be done first.
Yeah, yeah. Can imagine with visas and the like.
Yeah.
Brad Jack says, which artist has been the most fun to shoot with so far? Can you pin it down to one?
I mean, I'd probably have to say Libertines just because it was a lot of fun. But there was also a lot of misery as well.
Yeah.
And there's probably some band that I don't even remember that I just had a brilliant day with, but Christ knows who the hell that is now. But yeah, let's just say Libertines from that point of view. Well, and Dirty Pretty Things, that was always a lot of fun.
Did anyone surprise you in terms of how, like, affable they were or whatever, or when, if they had a certain reputation beforehand?
I think a lot of the hip-hop stars I work with, Snoop Dogg was one of the loveliest, sweetest people I've ever met. Eminem is similar, Ice-T. AC/DC, really, really good fun. Paul Weller's like one of the nicest people I've worked with as well, and a massive hero of mine. So I was really nervous meeting him, but he was just so down to earth. You know, there are a few people that are absolute arseholes as well. I don't tend to work with people like that more than once.
Yeah. That's funny. I saw you comment about the AC/DC shoot because you said how much fun they were to work with. And he said that indie dullards take note or something. That was quite funny. you get some people taking themselves a bit seriously type thing.
Yeah. Obviously. And that's the thing. When you see someone that's been around that long, that is still kind of interesting, fun, engaging and so on, it just makes you realize, you know, don't stop being so precious so early. Just get on with it.
And last few questions. One from Wichita Records saying, why are you more rock and roll than anyone you've ever photographed?
That's really funny. Thanks. I know who that is. It's because I got taught by him.
Ollie Burden says, can you tell when you've captured a classic shot or only find out when you go through them afterwards?
Sometimes you get an inkling, but sometimes... I mean, if it's like a structured shoot, but like that Libs cover, didn't think that shot was going to be anything. I only got two frames of that, and one of them, they've both got their eyes shut, and it's like twisted around like that. I might stick that up one day, actually, just to show how random that was.
Yes. Well, was there a bit of a mixed reaction to that, obviously, with, I don't know.
Well, that picture got kind of slipped under the radar a couple of times. It was only when Rough Trade asked me to get together a few images that might make a record cover, and I actually cropped it into a square, that we started looking at it slightly differently, really.
Yeah, but in terms of like...
Oh, I see.
The drug links, yeah.
Oh, I don't think, if I'm honest, I don't think Peter likes it. Or if he does now, then he certainly didn't for a long time because of that, because it made him look like a junkie. But that really wasn't the intention. I mean, I see it now, but it really wasn't the intention.
Yeah, I think most people who knew the band knew it was because of the tattoos, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then Marv from the Paddingtons, who we mentioned, he says hi first of all, and then he says, just says, talk about Prince.
I would. Everyone's going to hate me for this. I'm not really a Prince fan. I like a couple of songs, but yeah, that's not a popular thing to say. Sorry, Mark. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah, was it just live photos you did with him, or was it more?
It was. Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, you know, incredible showman and all that. And I think from that gig, that's the best picture that anyone got. And I don't usually sort of blow up my own stuff like that, but I really love that picture.
Yeah, is there anything you do differently from your career, do you think?
I mean, God, yes. There's lots of things I'd do differently, and there isn't enough time left on this to do it. But I think, I struggled with confidence a hell of a lot from from the beginning. And I think if I could have changed one big thing, that it would have been to work on my confidence and being more self-assured, because that handicapped me quite a lot. To, you know, there's from doing certain things and embracing certain situations, definitely.
All right.
A bit of a glum way to end, but it is true.
No, it's interesting because obviously like the relationships you've built, you know, people have obviously took to you. So is it just kind of in terms of opportunities, you mean?
Yeah, I turned down a Rolling Stone gig you know, things like that.
Okay.
Rolling Stones gig, sorry. They're just things like that, just never been the greatest self-promoter as well. And I think, yeah, just sort of being a bit more self-assured in certain situations would have really helped, definitely.
Okay. Well, let's finish on a good one then. Is there a high point from your career, would you say? You can pick multiple ones, I suppose.
I think, I don't know about career, but in terms of my experience of my own career, would definitely be, you know, the early days Libertine stuff. That was very exciting. Very close, followed by, you know, the Oasis in the 90s. Definitely.
Yeah, so for the benefit of people listening and watching on YouTube, after our initial chat, I realised there was quite a bit of extra information on the Snap galleries. And one picture I came across of Pete and Carl meeting up in 2005, because I didn't even realise this had happened. So can you tell us a bit about what happened there?
Yeah. So I think they had a really brief meeting, like for the very first time at the Dublin Castle, I believe. But the idea was to get together again, and it was hard. I think, well, it was hard getting them both in the same room at the same time. But I think Carl felt a little bit exposed, so he asked me to come along, and not like, you know, for like physical support or anything like that, but just for, you know, to have a mate there, basically. And and I know it may sound a bit weird, but I just thought it probably best just to fall into old ways, which would be to have my camera with me and to carry on, because they never really bothered, you know, whether or not they, you know, noticed me or not. They were always natural, so there was never really situations that I didn't feel I could take photos of, and it almost just felt normal. And so the best way to be would be normal. So I had my camera with me. The only odd thing about it was that Kate was there, and it's a very strange woman. This sort of moment happens with Peter and Carl, and I'm taking photos, and I don't feel like I'm intruding. I honestly don't. If I thought I was, I wouldn't have taken pictures. And then she just sort of plonks herself down next to him and says, "Don't take." Sorry, my dog's barking. And says, "Don't take pictures of me." So I just said, "Well, don't sit there then." And then spent most of the rest of the evening making very thinly veiled threats about what she'd done to other photographers. And I was the whole time just going, "What are you trying to say? Why are you trying to say that? You've got nothing. Look, I don't give a shit if you're here or not. I've absolutely no interest in you whatsoever." Oh, sorry. One second.
It's all right.
Shush. Yeah, I've got absolutely no interest in you whatsoever. I didn't say it in a horrible way, but I just said I'd prefer it if you weren't here, to be honest. But yeah, it was just really weird. You know, like, don't take my picture, but I'm going to sit right here and take my picture.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Like, so there were a lot of people that did try and insert themselves into history. Or history, sorry, it sounds a bit conceited, but, you know, do you know what I mean? Like, try to insert themselves into moments that might have possibly been, you know, important in the later day, you know?
No, I can imagine that, yeah. And I mean, this website's really interesting. But in terms of that meeting, then, were they just meeting up as mates, trying to, like, you know, keep that connection?
Trying to heal their very, very broken relationship at that time.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then, yeah, another picture. Just quickly wanted to mention the Brick Lane photo again, because I read that it might be that graffiti might have been done by Banksy. Is that right?
No, it was Banksy.
Ah, right. Okay, so that's interesting. Missed that.
Yeah, I only have a vague recollection of it was kind of weird back then. I only have a vague recollection of someone saying on the day that that was Banksy, but that definitely wasn't the reason that we did it. Back then, he wasn't that famous. And I remember, like, I sort of heard of him, but I, you know, he was none of the gravitas that he has now. And I remember doing a photo shoot with the others. Remember the others?
Yeah, yeah.
And you could barely walk around the East End of London without sort of falling over a bit of Banksy art. And they being like, oh no, can we not do a picture there? Because there's a Banksy on the wall. And it's kind of weird how things change, isn't it? But yeah, yeah. It was just a cool quote.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a nice twist of fate that it had turned out to be a Banksy, because I, you know, I do like it. And yeah, it's kind of nice.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, apparently hasn't his name been revealed or something recently? Did you read that?
I haven't. Yeah, very possibly. I've not kept up with that. Apparently, like, I was, you know, I met him once, but I don't remember.
Oh, right, okay. And yeah, I just read that you actually paid for your own flight to America to see the Libertines, and that was the only band you'd done that for. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was, again, you know, in retrospect, it's, it seems a bit weird to say this, but I really wanted to go out to America to see them, you know, on their first tour. And with every other band that I, you know, I don't mean this to sound unkind, but, you know, they sent people out when Smash and these Animal Men went to New York, but they weren't going to send anyone for the Libertines. And I just thought that was criminal. So, like, Rough Trade helped me. They sort of threw a little bit of work my way if I was going to go there. I mean, the NME weren't averse to it, but they would. I think they were. You know, they were like, "Oh, if you see one of the gigs, we'll give you a live review or something like that." So I just thought, oh, "Fuck it, I'm just going to go. It's too important not to." Yeah, and I'm obviously really glad I did, because it had to be the very last tour they ever did. Like, proper tour, you know, in the States.
Yeah, yeah. And with quite a few of them, it says, you know, the pictures were shelved for whatever reason for years in some cases, even like the Red Guards jacket one. What was that about?
Well, again, I mean, you know, I worked through the Britpop days and stuff, but I was sort of unaware of Menswear using Red Guard jackets in one of their photos until afterwards, really. But a lot of people just discounted that as a reason not to use those pictures. It's weird, like, you can't imagine that now. Like, if something looks good and works, you just go for it, don't you? But for some reason, there was still a lot of second guessing going on. Like, oh, you can't do that because people will think this. No one cared. 90% of people, no offense to Menswear, had never heard of Menswear. It was just about that kind of little bubble that the media lives in. No one gave a shit, really.
Yeah, yeah. Was that a management thing then?
No, it wasn't a management thing. Banny was managing them then, and she was brilliant. She was like, you know, she was slightly crazy, but she was brilliant. She was, you know, such a sort of inspirational force of nature and stuff. So she, you know, she helped out with the shoot. She was great. So yeah, and it was more kind of, I guess, not, you know, maybe people at the, I can't remember exactly. Maybe people at the label. Maybe Tony the PR. I'm not sure. It very much came from a backseat kind of way.
Oh, okay, right. And then just one more question, sorry, mate. Just one of the photos kind of shows you the work that goes into it. There's one where it said you've had a full day of shooting and it felt like you've got nothing and that the expectations have been high. Why did that not meet the mark, do you think?
So the first shoot we did, and there are some pictures out there from that. Like I say, they all wore different clothes. They looked like four people from four different bands. it was their first proper shoot, so it's understandable. But it's weird going back to those pictures now. There's some absolute gems, but it's kind of inevitable when bands first start out. They need a bit of time to get used to themselves and work out what they are and who they are. So this was the second shoot a couple of weeks later, and we had better ideas of what was going to work. And I'm a big fan of uniformity and making people feel like they belong together. And that's what we aim for with this. So hence the kind of leather jackets. And I mean, what one of them isn't. Well, I think like John's wearing Tony's jacket just so that we could get them looking a bit more cohesive, you know?
Okay, that's interesting. All right, well, we'll do a full podcast again, don't worry. So just to finish off, just wondered if you did have an Oasis story. No worries if not.
You only saw that when I read that email. The only thing I can just vaguely remember was, and it's not a brilliant story, but it's just the first time I saw them at that Walter Rat show. And I was right at the front the whole time. And I got that picture with Liam looking into the camera. And it was impressive, you know. It was the first sort of impressive band I'd seen for a long time. But I just always remember when the show finished. I don't know if you've ever been to the Water Rats, but the stage is probably about, I don't know, 10 centimetres high. It's not very big. Liam just sort of stepped off and shoulder barged me out of the way and walked off. And it was the first time I just thought, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, like, it wasn't mean sense, or anything. Yeah. It was just announcing his presence, you know.
Yeah. Okay, nice one, mate. Is there a particular song you'd want to play out to on the podcast?
God. I was listening to the second, this is a bit fucking random, but I was listening to the second Gorky's Zygotic Minky album yesterday, Tate. Anything from that would be great if you can find something.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Nice it's some sort of, I don't know if you know the band or know that record, but it's a mad psychedelic record.
Yeah, we've done a series on the top albums of 2001, and they're in the list. So I listened to an album of theirs. I don't know if it's the same one.
Tate, the second one, it's probably not. It's Tate, you can't. Came out in like 94, I think. You can't.
Oh, okay, right.
You can't. It's not on Spotify even. It's on YouTube though, so you'd have to rip it maybe. But there's this one song. I think it's like four songs in, and if you have to listen to it on headphones, but it's got two songs playing at the same time, one in one ear and one in the other. And right. It's kind of a bit mind-bending, but it's really beautiful as well. Thoroughly cool. Do you ever listen?
No, we'll do, yeah. And then last one, is there a picture of you with a band anywhere? I couldn't really find any.
There is. I can send you one, actually.
Okay, brilliant.
That I've just found, oddly enough. I haven't got the drive down here. I'll send it to you a little bit later. But yeah, I just found this. I was going to put some. It's a bit mad with the Instagram thing because I never know what to put where next, and I keep finding stuff because I'm just going through the digital archive at the moment, and the digital stuff I've never really looked at again after taking it. But I found this series of shots of Baby Shambles when we were at the when they were making the second album with Mick Jones. So it's in the studio, and there's just stuff I don't even remember. Like, you know, it was all daytime, so it's not like there's any sort of mad shenanigans going on, but just stuff I don't remember, like them getting in a boat and going on the river. And there's a photo of me with them anyway there, so I'll send you that.
Yes. And maybe one last one. Do you have any memories of working with the Paddingtons out of interest?
Oh, only really good ones. Like just smashing people, really. We went up to Hull to do the photo session with them, and it was one of the coldest shoots I've ever done, and literally in the snow and stuff. But we just had a brilliant time. They're just such a like, not in a cliched way, but just such a good time band, you know. Really, really lovely people. And it kind of changed my view of Hull. I'd only been there a couple of times before and it was fucking horrible. But just seeing real people in real places and stuff rather than just going to one venue, it was good.
Yeah, yeah. There's that good one outside the chip shop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there was bits in Hull that I'd never even knew existed, you know, the kind of, I don't know if it's like a redeveloped dock area or whatever, but it's really, really beautiful down there. Not something I thought I'd say about Hull. I've got a real fondness for the place now.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's definitely gone through big changes recently. I wonder if they treated you to a patty butty, if you remember what that is.
I think they did, but I can't remember what it is.
It's like a seasoned potato cake in a bread bun.
No, I don't think I did have that. I think I'd remember. La 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 la